welcome aboard. This is Leap to Faith. I am Michael Olson, your host for the evening. And Leap to Faith is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Churches of the Monterey Bay Area. But hey, we're not only interested in Lutherans out there, we're interested in everybody. So we encourage all of you, you can be one of those firewalkers for all we care. It doesn't matter what your faith or religion. We'd like to engage you in a little conversation about the Spirit. And we do this by basing our conversation on one of the texts from the Gospel, from the New Testament. But the issues raised, of course, are issues that touch us all one way or another, regardless of faith or religion. So pull yourself up a chair, grab your telephone, be ready to call. The numbers are tonight are 831-479-1380-477-1340. Tonight we're going to be looking at the Gospel of Matthew. And we have some great people here to engage us tonight. We've been having a real fun conversation before the show started, so I know we should have some fun on the air tonight. Starting off with Anton Prang, the newly retired pastor from Faith Lutheran in Seaside. So what's it like being retired?
I haven't quite figured that out yet. It's as I was saying to Grant on our way up here, it's a question of what do I do each day? There's plenty to do, but I have to decide each day what it is.
Life is full of fun choices now. One of the choices you made, though, is to become the producer of Leap to Faith, which is a great honor for us to have you aboard as the producer. You're the man responsible for bringing in guests. And, you know, having worked with a lot of the Lutheran pastors in the Monterey Bay Area Conference, I've come to know them as a bunch of all kinds of different people. They're as different as anybody else. So how do you go about picking who's going to be on a show together?
That I try to mix them up. Try to keep a good variety.
Okay.
It always helps to have different personalities and different views.
And of course, you know, the personality of the individual Lutheran churches are really reflected by their pastors, are they not?
Yes, that's certainly true. Each of us comes from a congregation or a parish with a different ministry and a different setting, mm-hmm. different history.
So the churches are really individuals in themselves, and it's kind of fun like that because people can really find a church that matches their personality mm-hmm. and go from there.
That's a good place just to visit a church. If you don't have a church now, visit one of your local churches. And I invite you to the Lutheran churches especially.
Yeah, and if with 17 Lutheran churches around, you're probably likely to find one that really matches your personality and character as well. Also with us this evening, we have Grant Voth. Welcome aboard, Grant.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
Grant is a retired lit teacher from Monterey Peninsula College. I'm really excited to have him aboard because I'm a student of literature. I have a degree in English and Chinese literature from UC. Grant has a PhD, and he's in Shakespeare, no less, and has been teaching at Monterey Peninsula College and recently retired. But at one time, you were considering going into the ministry as well.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I got as far as the seminary, and then
What was that one magic moment?
The moment
that flipped the switch for you.
It was the very first literature class I took in college.
Oh, really?
When I decided that this is where I really belong. So so I got as far as the seminary. In fact, Anton and I went to some of the same schools along the way. I did study for the ministry up until the time of the seminary, and then deflected off into literature rather than theology. It's just where he wound up.
You know, the same thing happened to me. I think it was a lit class in junior college. I had a professor, Doc Bardicky, down at San Diego City College, and he taught Shakespeare. And so I ended up in the Shakespeare class because I had to take a Shakespeare class to survive and go on. And Doc Bardicky, he handed out a bunch of paperback Shakespeares and said, okay, I don't want anybody reading these at home or in class or anywhere because we're going to read them aloud together in this class. And that just took me away. I mean, once I tasted that, it was just goodbye, Olson. I knew it was where I was going to go, so that's where I ended up.
It is amazing sometimes to think of what that one moment is that makes the decision that gives you the road that you're going to travel down for the rest of your life. That's kind of an interesting story.
Well, as a professor of literature, how does the Bible hold up as literature?
The Bible is a great work of literature. They used to do in newspapers years ago, they used to ask celebrities to pick if you had one book that you're going to take to a desert island you'd have to read over and over again for the rest of your life, to pick a book. And there were quite a few people who chose the Bible, and that would not be a bad choice, because there are all manner of different kinds of stories. There's great poetry, you know, there's great narrative, there's action. I mean, it's got every imaginable kind of literature in it. As literature, it is a great book, a really great book.
Well, let me ask you this, and I'm probably getting in big trouble for this, but my Shakespeare professor said once, he said, look, Olson, all the good stories are about fighting and fornicating. And, of course, that's what Shakespeare was. But any of that in the Bible?
There's quite a lot of that in the Bible, actually. It's quite a lot of that. And interestingly, most people in my generation, anyway, knew the Bible in the King James Version.
Right.
And the King James Version and Shakespeare, of course, grew out of the same
language.
Right. They were, in effect, between the two of them, probably created a lot of the modern English language. So, in a way, there's a lot of commonality between the language of Shakespeare and language of the New Testament, the Bible.
And you know, that's probably something people don't realize, is that's really where our language came from, was from Shakespeare and the Bible, right?
Mm-hmm. They really created modern English, you know, in a way. Those two great books came, you know, the King James Version was 1611, I think, and Shakespeare finished writing about 1613, so that they really are very contemporary with each other, and that is where the English language comes from. So,
boy, I could have a lot of fun just going down this road with you, Grant, for hours, I think so. But I better get back on track here. So we're talking about Matthew chapter 17, verses 1 to 9. And let's talk a little bit before we go into Matthew and talk about the church calendar, because this is the last Sunday in Epiphany, and marking one of the seasons of the church. And, of course, these seasons really parallel kind of what's going on in the Bible. I guess let's start with Christmas, the Christmas season. Anton, take us through the seasons of the church here so we know where we're at.
Okay, the seasons of the church here are important in the Lutheran church. We keep coming back to them. It really starts with Advent, as the 4 weeks before Christmas. Christmas, of course, we all know about.
And what is Advent?
Days of Christmas. Advent, well, the word comes from the Latin to come.
Something's
coming.
It
points to the coming of the Christ.
Okay.
In this case, very specifically, the coming at Christmas as the baby of Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm. And in the Christmas season, how's that broken down?
The Christmas season is 12 days. There are 12 days of Christmas, from the 25th to the 6th, or the 5th of January. And then the 6th is, in the Western Church at least, is the beginning of the season of Epiphany. Epiphany, then we enter, have
Epiphany,
a Greek word.
Yeah, Epiphany, of course, means to make known, right?
To make known, to reveal. And the child is revealed to the outsiders, the wise men, the magi, at the Epiphany.
And this Sunday is the last season in Epiphany, which is kind of a special Sunday, because it's Transfiguration Sunday, which means that Jesus is really revealed to us as the Son of God on this particular text, right?
Right. This is an especially glorious Epiphany. Probably, at least in the New Testament, the most glorious of the Epiphanies in terms of what we would expect of an Epiphany.
What comes after the Epiphany, in the season in which Jesus is revealed to us? What happens after?
Well, I think a lot of us know what happens next week. We get to Fat Tuesday or Mardi Gras, and then Ash Wednesday. And in the church year, in the Western church year, Ash Wednesday begins the season of Lent, which is now we are coming not to the birth of the Christ child, but coming to the death of the Christ.
Mm-hmm. So heading down the road to Jerusalem after this Sunday. So
exactly what the disciples are doing as they come down from the Mountain of Transfiguration.
Okay, before we go up to that Mountain of Transfiguration, where have we been? So take us, kind of set the stage for this, kind of paraphrase what has gone on in Matthew's Gospel before we go to the top of the mountain for the Transfiguration.
Matthew has recorded a lot of the teachings sermons of Jesus. We had the Sermon on the Mount. That's three full chapters before this time. And there's a training of the disciples, which comes to a climax just in the chapter before, this 6 days before, when Jesus asks his disciples, whom do people say that I am? And the disciples say, well, some say you're Elijah, some say you're the prophet returned, and so on. And then he says, but whom do you say that I am? And Peter responds, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And this sounds like everything is coming to fullness for Jesus at this point. And now 6 days later, a short week later, we have this special event we'll hear about tonight.
In Matthew, in fact, chapters 16 through 20 are really focused on the relationship between Jesus and his disciples. There isn't much controversy here. There isn't much argument with the scribes and the Pharisees and the other people who contest with Jesus. This is really a time when Jesus and his disciples go off, and he explains in more detail than he ever has before his understanding of his mission and where he's going to go. And so that this particular moment, the Transfiguration moment, happens in the context of that special community of disciples and Jesus that's being established in this section.
So before we go up to the mountain, Jesus has sat his disciples down and told them that he's heading down the road to Jerusalem then.
And he says it again as when they come down, right. Yes.
Right there. In fact, this whole chapter 16 through 20, there are three separate moments when Jesus explains very carefully that his way now is the way to Jerusalem, and that's the way of suffering, and those kind of punctuate the other teachings that go on in between these. But they're those three great moments.
Do the disciples accept this? I mean, here. They're following somebody who's telling them that he's heading down the road to Jerusalem, and it's going to be nothing but suffering and pain. And I mean, how did the disciples read this?
Well, we have the incident right before this, as I mentioned, where Peter says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the Living God," and a couple of verses later, Peter's trying to tell Jesus, "No, you don't need to take that road." And that's that famous saying, Jesus tells him, get thee behind me, Satan.
Right. Although in this particular passage, when Jesus comes down from the Mountain of Transfiguration, he says to the disciples, don't say anything to anybody about this until after my resurrection. Now, the resurrection implies the death. And in this case, in Matthew, at any rate, the disciples don't ask any questions about that. They simply say they accept that. They go on to ask some other questions, but that one they don't ask about, which means that as far as this story is concerned, the disciples, it either goes over their heads and they don't catch it at all, or else they do understand. Because they don't ask that. They don't ask. In Mark, they do. They say, what is this about the death? But in Matthew, they don't. They pass go right past that.
They've had that argument before.
Right.
Seems to have settled it, at least for the time being.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break right now. And when we come back, we're going to go to the mountain for the Transfiguration. This section of Matthew raises an interesting question that we would like to ask you out there. What kind of God do you prefer? One that appears in all of his glory and strength, or one that appears nailed to a cross? What are you looking for? 831-479-1080 and 477-1340. This is Leap to Faith. I am Michael Olson, and tonight we have Anton Prang and Grant Voth, and we're going to have a lot of fun looking at the Bible with you, so do stay tuned.
You're tuned in to the Leap to Faith radio program. Leap to Faith is brought to you by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, by the Churches of the Monterey Bay Area Lutheran Conference, and by listeners just like you. We cordially invite you to experience the gospel lesson being discussed in today's program in Sunday's worship service. One of the principles that Martin Luther championed was that scriptures and worship need to be in the language of the neighborhood. There are 17 neighborhood Lutheran churches in the Monterey Bay area, and some of them are in yours. For Lutheran churches near you, log on to our website at www.leaptofaith.org. If you'd like to make a donation to the Leap to Faith radio ministry, please send it to Leap to Faith, care of St. Stephen's Lutheran Church, 2500 Soquel, Santa Cruz, California, 95062. You can also make a donation by logging on to www.leaptofaith.org. Now let's go back to Leap to Faith.
Welcome back out there. This is Leap to Faith. I am Michael Olson. This evening we're talking about Matthew chapter 17, verse 1 to 9. It's the last season of Epiphany, and this section of the Gospel is known as the Transfiguration. And of course, the Transfiguration means what, Anton?
Metamorphosis is the actual word. Change of form.
Okay.
Something changes here.
And with us this evening to discuss this piece of gospel text, we have Anton Prang and Grant Voth from Seaside. And it's so wonderful to have you aboard. Anton is a recently retired pastor from Faith Lutheran in Seaside. And now he spends most of his time surfing and having a good time. And Grant Voth is a retired lit professor from Monterey Peninsula College. It's specialized in Shakespeare. So we've been having a great conversation about Shakespeare off the air. And earlier we were talking about how, in fact, Shakespeare and the Bible really, really fashioned our English language. And before that, it was kind of a jumble, wasn't it not?
At least the language was in the process of being created. Shakespeare himself spells his name something like 15 or 16 different ways on the signatures that we have that have survived. So even names, there's nothing like standard spelling. There's nothing like standard grammar, and so it is the King James Bible and Shakespeare in a way that
the
show what the English language was capable of. And
well, folks, right now we're going to go to Matthew chapter 17, verse 1 to 9, and this reads as follows. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up 3 shelters for you, one for Moses and one for Elijah." While he was speaking, a bright cloud enveloped them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." When they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." And that ends the reading. You know, when I read through this several times, and it's really literary in its presentation. And so I was really glad that Grant Voth, the retired literature professor, showed up to help us work through this. After 6 days, again, what were we doing in the preceding 6 days, Anton?
We had heard the confession of St. Peter and some discussion about what the Christ should be about.
And Jesus is telling him that he's headed down the road to Jerusalem.
To be betrayed, to suffer, to die, mm-hmm. and to rise again.
And Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the son of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. Jesus seems to take these 3 disciples with him up on top of mountains again, doesn't he? In Gethsemane, doesn't he take...
Okay, the Mount of Gethsemane, the Garden of Gethsemane, doesn't seem to have the same role, but you're right. They do appear there. They also, in the Gospel of Mark, they're the three that get to go in to watch Jesus raise the daughter of Jairus. So it is apparently an inner group of disciples that have special responsibilities and special privileges.
And as such, of course, Matthew isn't in on this, is he? Which means that this is not first person.
No, it is not first person. And in fact, if you know, the text says transfigured before them. He says them. It's always third person. But it is interesting, I think, that what Matthew does, Matthew is very careful to make sure that we understand this experience from the point of view of the disciples, so that we're actually getting the disciples' experience as it's told by Matthew, so that we get their reactions. They're the ones who are overwhelmed. They're the ones that don't know quite what to do. They're the ones who are so thunderstruck when the voice appears from the cloud that they fall in their faces. And so that Matthew is, he's not one of the three, but he is nevertheless careful to make sure that we understand exactly what it felt like to be there from the point of view of either Matthew or Peter, James, or John.
Going on, he was then transfigured. And this is where we really go into the powerful stuff, is it not? I mean, this is the true epiphany of epiphanies.
This is Jesus appearing, well, in modern art it would be with a halo, but with a brightness that was blinding. When I think of the word glory, and that's a word I apply here, I think of a brightness that it's like looking into the sun. This is my sense.
I was thinking of people with near-death experiences just when you were talking about that, Anton, and the light, and people seeing this light, and it really sounds the same, doesn't it?
In fact, if you look at this from a sort of psychological point of view, excuse me, asking the questions about what it felt like to be a disciple, the idea of the voice coming from the cloud and the white light and this intuitive certainty that you absolutely know is the kind of characteristic of mystical experience down through history. And if you look at the epistle lesson for this Sunday, which is from 2 Peter, Peter makes this the keystone of his belief when he says, you know we're telling the truth because I was there, I saw this. And so that moment for him becomes the kind of pivotal, defining moment in his understanding of who the Christ is. And so that it has to be an amazingly powerful, overwhelming experience. Probably scary, too. I mean, frightening, terrifying, because the disciples can't manage it. They land down, face down on the ground. But yes, it has all of the same qualities that a great mystical experience does when you just know a whole bunch of things come together and you're absolutely certain that you understand.
A parenthetical here. Why are we reading Matthew's account of this as the gospel instead of Peter's?
Because this is the first year in a series of a 3-year cycle. And next year we'll read Mark's account, and the following year we will read Luke's account. Okay. And they are very, very similar.
And of course, Peter didn't write a gospel, so
that's right. Peter was, by tradition, we believe that Peter was the source of Mark's gospel.
When you say the epistle, what does that mean?
Oh, the epistle is the letter. Traditionally, in Lutheran church services, there's an Old Testament lesson, there's a gospel lesson, and then there's an epistle lesson. And the epistle lesson is usually a letter, usually a Pauline letter, but this time, this week it comes out to be from Peter, a letter from Peter addressed to believers, reminding them. He says, in fact, in his epistle, that I know from what's happening that I'm not going to be with you very long, but I want to write this letter to tell you so that you know what you need to know to stay faithful after I'm gone. And what he says is that I tell you I was with him. I saw this. That transfiguration is an amazing moment for him.
And so you can depend on his word because he was there.
He was there. So you have Mark's third-person account, Peter's first-person account.
Right.
So
right.
So you really, what you have here is a transfiguration.
Also, part of the importance of this scene is that for Matthew's first readers, who were undoubtedly familiar with the Old Testament scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures, this is a reminder of what Moses went through on the Mount Sinai.
You have the thunderous voice
of God. You have the lightning. You have Moses going up on the mountain.
And verse 4, Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And so we're on top of a mountain. We have this brilliant flash. And again, what happened to Moses on a mountain?
He received the word of God, what we refer to as the Ten Commandments. He also came down after one encounter with God with a face that people couldn't look at.
Yes.
Because he had seen the backside of God, and that was so much it had transfigured him.
And as a matter of fact, Elijah, the other person who appears here, had a mountaintop experience too. So
you guys are moving so fast, I can't even answer a question.
What we have here is we have three mountaintop experiences all kind of packed together, two from the Old Testament account and now this New Testament account, all put together in this one story.
And this would seem then, if you didn't know the whole story of Jesus, you would say, this must be the end.
Right.
Yeah.
Because what Matthew is doing, as we understand it, what Matthew is writing is he's writing his gospel primarily for people who would have known the Jewish Bible. And what he's doing here is he's always making connections back to that Jewish Bible so that people understand that what he's describing here is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. And he's talking about the fulfiller of the Old Testament. Here we get Moses, representative of the law, Elijah, representative of the prophets. So you have the whole tradition of the law and the prophets from the Old Testament now being fulfilled, because the three of them stand and talk together. Jesus, Elijah, and Moses stand and talk together. So there's this continuity, this amazing fulfillment, this amazing transition that happens. It's not opposition. It's a matter of Moses and Elijah recognizing that in Jesus, this is what they were talking about. This is where they were headed. And all three of them have this great conversation.
And what is Peter doing? Oh, this is wonderful. Let me build a tent for each one of you so we can hang around up here.
Well, that's one way to read this and the way the translations usually read it. But one possibility is that there's a question mark here. He's saying, is it good that we're here? What are we supposed to do?
Right.
Build houses for them?
I mean, this experience has got to be amazingly overwhelming. Anton and I met on Monday to talk about these passages, and one of the things that we recalled is the fact that other religious traditions have the same kind of experience described, the experience of God being revealed in all of his glory, and it always is terrible, terribly frightening. It always knocks you out. It always is so devastating. In Greek mythology, if Zeus ever reveals himself as fully God, it kills the person who sees it. In Hindu mythology, you know, there's a great moment in the Bhagavad Gita where Arjuna gets to see Krishna as Vishnu, or Vishnu as Krishna in all of his glory, and he can only stand it for a few seconds. You know, he says, stop, that's enough, please go back to being Krishna.
It's like embracing a lightning bolt.
Right, it is, and it just is so devastating that you can understand why Peter would be flustered at the moment. How would we respond? How would we behave?
Well, isn't that the way we think that God should be revealed to us as this magnificent tower of strength, this awesome, this so awesome you can't comprehend it, powerful, dynamic, and yet here we have Jesus is heading down the road to Jerusalem.
On one side, we want our God to be that glorious and powerful, but then in his presence, we can't help but know we don't belong there.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's why I think this gospel lesson, for my taste, if I would button to pick the gospel, I would have added the next three verses onto this gospel as well, because as they're coming down the mountain, Jesus says, don't tell anybody until the Son of Man be raised from the dead. As we said earlier, the disciples pass right over that. They don't bother with that. But then they ask, why is it that the prophets say that Elijah should come back first before the Messiah comes? And Jesus endorses that. He says the scribes were right. Elijah is to come before the Messiah comes. But he says Elijah has already been here. And he says, and Elijah has already come, and they did not know him, but did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will suffer at their hands. And then Matthew says, then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. So what Jesus tells them is Elijah has come back. That's been fulfilled. He was John the Baptist. Look what happened to him.
Sure, and John the Baptist was the prophet, wasn't
yes.
he?
Right.
Repent.
Right. The last of the prophets,
yeah.
Right.
Repent, the end is near.
And so he says, you know, you see what happened to John the Baptist? The Son of Man will have to take that same road. And it seems to me that the wonderful thing about this story is the fact that it's got that great balance between the transfiguration, the glory on the one hand, and then the coming down the mountain into the plain of suffering and death on the other. And they need each other to make this story complete. The transfiguration, the seeing God in his glory is okay, but it overwhelms us. It can kill us if we try to take it in. On the other hand, we have the suffering Christ, which is just a funeral dirge if we don't have the glory on the other hand. But you put the two together, and it's a marvelous, marvelous story. Paradoxical, but it's a great story. That's the balance that counts.
And before we go to the break here, I want to go to this last instruction by Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." Here's this incredible epiphany, a revelation. Jesus as the Christ in all of his glory. But hey, don't tell anybody. Why?
I've run across two explanations for this, and you can add to those, Anton. But the first one is political. This one, Jesus has seen already that if people go around saying he's the Messiah, this is not going to do anybody any good. This is just going to cause a lot of trouble. So, one, don't do it for that reason. And the second reason, I think, is that for the disciples, this experience of the transfiguration won't mean anything until after the resurrection. Because it's after the resurrection that we do see the glorified, risen Christ. The psalm for this Sunday is Psalm 2, and that one talks about the fact that when the Son of Man comes, no one will recognize him, but there will come a time when he will be raised by God to glory, and God will give him dominion over everything. And I think that in the context of this story, what Jesus is simply saying is, after the resurrection, then it's okay. Then it's okay to say this, because then all of this will make sense. You will understand it. The story will be complete. And so then those are the two explanations that I have for that. Anton may have a third or fourth.
Oh, very much like your second one there. I thought of, when was Jesus revealed so boldly as he was at this point? Probably the closest time was in the feeding of the 5,000, where many saw this miraculous feeding of all of them. And what happens? Right away, he has to avoid being raised up on their shoulders and claimed as the bread king.
Right.
So he needs to avoid that.
Right. The understanding of what the Messiah was going to be, there were various understandings of this. And what Jesus is doing with his disciples here in this section of Matthew is teaching them what it means to be the Messiah, what the Messiah is, what the road of the Messiah is. And that's why, in part, I think that what he's teaching them here is that the road of the Messiah is down into the plain of the passion and the crucifixion. That's not the way everybody would have understood the Messiah, and to go around saying that this is the Messiah would have misled people who hadn't been given that special instruction that the disciples have been here, that special teaching, I think.
There you go. Leap to Faith. Michael Olson here. We're talking the Transfiguration. As told by Matthew in chapter 17, verse 1 to 9, a book written a couple thousand years ago, and when we get back from this break, we're going to ask the really fun question of just what does this mean for us today? Does the Transfiguration hold any meaning? I mean, for those of us who are living here on Easy Street, you know, the nice homes, the fast cars, the sushi on demand, does this 2,000-year-old text hold any meaning for us at all? What do you think? I'd love to hear from you. Phone numbers 831-479-1080, 477-1340. Do join us. We will be right back.
You're tuned in to the Leap to Faith radio program. Leap to Faith is brought to you by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, by the Churches of the Monterey Bay Area Lutheran Conference, and by listeners just like you. We cordially invite you to experience the gospel lesson being discussed in today's program in Sunday's worship service. One of the principles that Martin Luther championed was that scriptures and worship need to be in the language of the neighborhood. There are 17 neighborhood Lutheran churches in the Monterey Bay area, and some of them are in yours. For Lutheran churches near you, log on to our website at www.leaptofaith.org. If you'd like to make a donation to the Leap to Faith radio ministry, please send it to Leap to Faith, care of St. Stephen's Lutheran Church, 2500 Soquel, Santa Cruz, California, 95062. You can also make a donation by logging on to www.leaptofaith.org. Now let's go back to Leap to Faith.
Zoom, we're right back. This is Leap to Faith. Michael Olson here. Folks, we're talking transfiguration. We're talking about three men on a mountain being illuminated for us to see. We've got Anton Prang, we have Grant Voth, and we have you. Phone numbers are 831-47-1980, 477-1340. Grant Voth, you've been teaching Shakespeare and literature forever. Shakespeare wrote a long time ago about different times, different people, and yet, as a college student, I remember so fondly those evenings when we'd sit around with a jug of wine and a bunch of Shakespeare books, and each one of us would take a part, and in an instant, we would be right there with Shakespeare as if time mattered not at all. Is this the same here? I mean, can we find the same kind of meaning in this?
I think so. It's one of the ways that I like to approach texts is to look at the text in terms of the changes it makes on older texts. Somebody said, I think it was Harold Bloom who said once, that every text is a rewrite of an older text. There is no such thing as a brand new text. What Matthew is doing, of course, is rewriting in part the Hebrew Bible, is rewriting that. So that, in a way, what you're looking for here is you're looking for those places that Matthew wants to link back. It's interesting, for example, just a little tiny detail, that when Mark tells this story, he says Elijah and Moses. Matthew says Moses and Elijah. And you think, why would he have turned those around? What difference does it make, the order in which they come? Commentators have said, well, maybe because Matthew is more in tune with that Old Testament tradition, that Hebrew Bible tradition. And so when you say the law and the prophets, you say Moses and Elijah. You don't say Elijah and Moses. And so just little tiny details like that, ways in which he just makes these little tiny changes.
As precise as a tax collector might be, right?
Yes, yes, as precise. And because what Matthew's doing, in a way, is he is rewriting an older text which looks complete and is apparently complete in itself. And what he is doing is adding on to that text, continuing it. And he's continuing the Hebrew Bible. And I think that's one of the ways in which this becomes really interesting as literature, because for Matthew, this is the Old and New Testament make this great organic whole. Neither one of them is quite complete without the other. You need both of them, and you put them together, and they make this magnificent story, and that's where the real literature is here, for Matthew anyway.
So it's real literature, but then Michael's question is, what does it say? Is it relevant today?
Yes.
What difference does it make?
What difference does it make? And again, thinking about approaching this the same way I approached the last question, that is, if you're asking the question of what changes does Matthew make, if you're asking the question about what is in this story that isn't in other religious traditions, Anton
and of course, transfigurations are in most of other religions.
Other religions do always have moments
like this. Let me start there then, by golly. What are we looking for in transfigurations, that all of our religions have a transfiguration? What is it that we're missing here today in the here and now with everything that we have to stuff our lives filled with? What are we missing that we seek transfigurations? If we get disgruntled with Christianity, we run away to Buddhism, and we find a transfiguration there, and wherever we bounce around, we seem to find this transfiguration. What is it that in this transfiguration that we seem to need? Ooh. You want to throw something at me?
I think that it is just the grandeur, the glory of God. I mean, years ago, somebody wrote a book called Your God is Too Small. And I think there are times in which it is useful and well and therapeutic for us to recognize the magnificence, the holiness, the grandeur of God. I think transfigurations give us that. They give us the sense of our own smallness. They give us a sense of our own contingency. They remind us of where we fit in the scheme of things. And it does so in a dramatic and powerful way that allows us to see things in a new scale. Going back to that story I was telling before about from the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna doesn't know what to do next. And so he says, I don't know that I'm on the right track. So what Krishna does is he reveals himself as Vishnu. He reveals himself, tells him a few things. And what happens is that Arjuna can emerge from that knowing exactly what it is that he's supposed to do next, because now he understands. He understands his place. He understands the cosmos. He understands everything. He understands reality in a way, which is that vision of God, that's what it gives us. It grounds us in a way in ultimate reality. And I think we all need that as part of our religious experience. I think that's important. I think that's a really important dimension. It's not the only one, but it has to be one.
Doesn't it also give us a little boost in the knowledge that there is a force out there that's doing this transfiguring? That, gee whiz, maybe we're not just these mechanical human beings that somehow evolved out of nothingness, and that there's something, somebody, a God up there who can transfigure things in front of our eyes.
There's something beyond the mortal,
the nothingness of being a regular old human being that just born and we just die and we blow away and there's nothing.
Except that I think that the importance of the transfiguration and the story of Jesus is that it doesn't settle the question of our relationship to God or ourselves or the world around us. That's only settled when Jesus comes back down to earth and gets nailed to a cross.
Right. And, or he comes back down from the mountain and heads down the road to Jerusalem.
That goes back to that point of what I was saying earlier, that other religious traditions have birth stories. Other religious traditions have miracle stories. Other religious traditions have even resurrection stories. But the crucifixion is really a unique part of the Christian story. And I think that what this story does, what the Transfiguration story does, is in some paradoxical and ironic way, it leads us to the crucifixion. It leads us to crucifixion because it's by appearing with Elijah that causes the disciples to say, what is Elijah doing here? What is this all about? And then Jesus says, Elijah's already been here, and you know what happened to John the Baptist. The same thing is going to happen to the Son of Man. And so that same God who's revealed in glory on the mountaintop now walks down to the plains to be crucified and to die. And that's the really amazing part of this story, I think. What makes this different from other stories and other religious traditions.
And we wish we had a God who always appeared in glory beside us and showed us exactly what to do next.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Right.
But our God knows us better than that. He knows that's not really what we need.
Right.
So a few minutes left. I'd like to play a little game here. Grant, you've been a lit professor for a long time. You've got a class of advanced lit students out there sitting in their cars driving down Highway 1. How do you teach this transfiguration as literature?
As literature, I guess, this is coming at it through the back door, but this is something, again, that Anton and I talked about earlier, is that one of the things that occurs to me is I'm always interested in the human dimension of this. How do people respond to this kind of experience? In this case, Peter, James, and John,
Peter's always so human, isn't he?
What do they take with them from this mountain experience? And one of the things that's really interesting is we've talked about this. If Peter, James, and John have seen Jesus in his glory, then they should understand the crucifixion when it happens in a different way than they do. Somehow, along the process of that week in Jerusalem, this lesson escapes them. They miss the point. They have seen that this is the Son of God. They have heard God announce that. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. And they forget that somehow. So that they're frightened, they're terrified, they gather in the upper room, they don't know what's happening.
They're just like the rest of us.
They're like the rest of us. They're like the rest of us. Somehow in times of crisis, the one great comfort that they should have taken with them from that mountaintop gets away from them. Mm. And that, I guess, is the kind of thing that, again, thinking about our church year, which is where we started, that the church wants to remind us of, too, before we descend into this 6 weeks of Lent, before we go through the passion, the suffering, that Holy Week, the death again, what it wants to remind us, this is the Son of God. This is the Son of God. And if we remember that as we go through these 6 weeks, we'll do a slightly better job than the disciples did of keeping this, yeah, keeping track of all this.
Okay. Anton, you're a pastor for many, many years. You've got a congregation of people sitting out in their cars driving down Highway 1. How do you teach this piece of Matthew as scripture?
Well, it's not only a theoretical question in this case, because I am
there you
a guest
go.
Preacher at Messiah in Santa Cruz, okay, on 800 there. High Street this Sunday,
at
8 and 10 a.m.
There you go,
8 and 10 a.m. And I believe I'm going to talk about how does glory appear in our own lives, the glory of God. How have we experienced, how has God epiphanized, appeared to us in glory, and what has that made a difference? I think that often we forget about it in crisis, as mm-hmm. Grant pointed out, and or we just don't connect it with reality. And I guess that's what leads to the forgetting. It's something set aside.
What about those of us who have not, for whom there has not been an epiphany? What about for those of us who have not seen the glory of God in our lives?
I could ask that or answer that question in a couple of ways. One, the glory of God has been there. I'm convinced of that.
But why haven't
we seen it?
Well, we just got a new Mercedes-Benz.
Yeah. And that's the glory of God?
And we're really comfortable.
Okay. And we've ordered sushi.
And we've ordered we could eat sushi whenever we wanted. And so our lives are filled, and we just
and where is the glory? How has God been? How have we experienced the epiphany of God? I think that's part of my point, that the glory of God has been around us and available to us, and at many times we've actually seen it, but we've forgotten or we've been blind to it. Yeah. And I think we need to ask ourselves again and again, where has God appeared to me today?
I think also that this story doesn't come to completion until the resurrection. That's the point at which this all really makes sense.
Yeah.
That's the point at which Peter can look back and say, I get it now. And so that when Peter says in the Second Peter, the epistle for this Sunday, when he says, this is the bedrock. This is it. I was there. I saw this. What he's saying is, I know this. I know this to be the case. Jesus says, don't tell anybody about this till after the resurrection, because after the resurrection, it will all fall into place. Then it becomes one of these kind of intuitive experiences where all the teachings, all the things you've experienced, all the things you've known in your life, all click into some moment where you say, I know it. It's true. And that, I think, is the glory of God. That's the moment at which we find it, is those moments. It doesn't have to be literally on a mountain. It doesn't have to be literally anywhere. It can be in your Mercedes as you're driving down the road. It can be some moment when all of a sudden all this stuff comes together and you say, that's it.
Isn't that the sad part about, you know, life, is that when we're young we see and experience all of these things, but nothing makes any sense until it's almost too late. So quick question for both of you. What kind of God do you prefer? One that appears in all of his glory, like that on the mountain, or one that appears nailed to a cross? Anton?
I prefer the God of glory, because he brings the Mercedes along with him. But I know that the God I need and the God that has come into my life is a God who gets nailed on a cross, then rises again.
Mm-hmm. Grant?
Yeah, see, that's, again, that's the uniqueness of this tradition, is that many religions have gods of glory. Not very many have gods who suffer the most ignominious kind of death imaginable on the cross. And what Christianity proclaims is a religion that has a God that is both. It is both the God who suffers and who is therefore fully human, but also the God of glory. And the Transfiguration Sunday, coming when it does here, is a reminder of those two aspects of our God that is marvelous. I mean, it's absolutely amazing.
Now, this Sunday appears as one bookend, with Easter as the other bookend to the Lent.
Right.
And Easter, Holy Week.
So if you really want to get the experience, you need to go to church this Sunday and experience Transfiguration Sunday. Anton, you're going to be preaching at Messiah. Tell us about, where's Messiah at?
800 High Street in Santa Cruz.
Up by the university.
Right. 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock are the services, 9 o'clock, 9:15, the education hour.
Grant, where are you going to church?
Probably at Bethlehem back in Monterey.
Monterey. And, what time?
And the services there are 8 and 10.
Good.
8 and 10:30.
So, gosh, we got 1 minute left. What do we want to take from Transfiguration?
From Transfiguration, for me, you take from it this kind of amazing God who is both the God who is nailed to the cross and the God who rises, and whose resurrection then makes the Transfiguration.
Out of time. Thank you, Anton Prang, Grant Voth. Ooh, what fun. Leap to Faith, Michael Olson.
Leap to Faith. Leap to Faith is brought to you by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, by the Churches of the Monterey Bay Area Lutheran Conference, and by listeners just like you. If you'd like to make a donation to this radio ministry, please send it to Leap to Faith, care of St. Stephen's Lutheran Church, 2500 Soquel, Santa Cruz, California, 95062. You can also make a donation by logging on to leaptofaith.org. We cordially invite you to experience the gospel lesson discussed in today's program in Sunday's worship service. For a church near you, log on to our website at www.leaptofaith.org. Now let's go out and leap to faith.